Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast. Think of us as the life raft that you're just about grabbing hold of in the rough seas of writing. As the people on a luxury cruise liner wave at you and laugh.
Here we are again, Tom.
Yes, we are.
We're back. What episode are we on, by the way? It feels like we've done loads, but you haven't done that many, have we?
Three.
Is it episode three?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Season three, episode three. We've got an interesting little episode today. We've got an interview with a writer. But before we get on to the interview with the writer, I thought it would be interesting to talk about one of our past guests who has created a little bit of a Twitter storm.
Yeah.
If you haven't noticed, Andy Stanton is bringing out a book called Benny the Blue Whale. And
what's it about, John?
It's about a blue... Well, it's about a blue whale called Benny.
Mm-hmm. Seems normal who, so far. Yeah.
It does. Who has a tiny penis.
Oh.
And it's been partly created using ChatGPT. The AI writing bot. And it seems to have not gone down, or the news seems to have not gone down very well. And people seem to have been taking it quite personally.
Yeah.
Do you want me to read out some responses?
Yeah, the Luddites came out in force, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, yeah. This is what the headline said. It said, One World signs Andy Stanton adult debut. Mr. Gum creator uses ChatGPT to help write Benny the Blue Whale, and things got interesting when he prompted it to tell me a story about a blue whale with a tiny penis. And basically, the rest of the article was behind a paywall, so I'm guessing no one else read anything else other than that bit.
I don't think, in this day and age, though, you don't need to know the content of something to draw a strong opinion.
Oh, God, no.
The headline is enough.
Yeah, easily.
Absolutely.
So with that, some of the responses were, I will never buy a book written with AI, and I will boycott any author that uses it. That was one of the early ones. And then
balanced and fair.
Yeah. The next one, disgusting.
Interesting. Sorry, just to stop on that one. Yeah. The very question is AI gets better. There's an interesting angle of how would you know? And there's an element of these
people that
critique it that think it's a bad thing that would say, well, we would know. But it's one of those difficult ones, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm not.
It's like saying you'll never watch a film with special effects in.
Yeah,
but
I'm not saying that I don't like the idea of, you know, the robots writing books for us. Because
is that what you want, John? Is that what you want?
No, it's like I feel exactly the same as everybody else. I don't. I want it to go away.
It's not gonna though, is it?
No, it's not gonna. Let's be totally honest. I'll read some more of these.
Yeah.
Disgusting. The beginning of the end for me feels like the last 7 years of countless hours and hard work have been, at best, grossly devalued, if not a complete waste. Mm. That's someone taking it very personally, like it's an actual personal attack on them, which is quite interesting. And I think a lot of people felt, to be fair, I think a lot of people felt that way.
Yeah, because it's when they've obviously been putting in the hours and pouring the soul into writing something and they feel... I think a lot of these people as well were completely unaware of Andy Stanton's back catalogue and place within the writing community.
Well, this
like.
Is what I was going to get to.
A lot of them
seemed
to think he was just some random newbie that had never written anything before and had just thought, oh, right, I can write a book.
Yeah, because it does say it's his first adult book.
But to be fair, there seems to be some of that knocking around of kind of get-rich-quick schemes on writing now because you could just put it into the ChatGPT and get it back out.
Is there any evidence to show that people are writing full novels with ChatGPT?
Not that I know of.
You suspect there might be.
Yeah, no, but I think that's the moral panic around it, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. Anyway, I'm going to read some more. Absolute trash. A scam. Then things got a little bit more nasty. He looks exactly like someone who collaborates like this. He has a very punchable face. Eat a turd. Get fucked. He started turning a little bit nastier.
It's relatively harsh, that, isn't it, when you think about it?
Just a little bit.
When you analyse when you read between the lines, there's some microaggressions in there.
The subtext there, I think, is a little bit strong.
I mean, sorry, but it is funny. He looks like the kind of person that would... It's just kind of such a thing that there's a look of a person that would willingly sort of work with robots.
He's one of those robot-y type people.
These will be the people that bring our downfall, John.
Exactly.
Those types.
So my first thought was, and I'm kind of aware that this will probably make me unpopular with some writers for saying this, but I'm happy to go on record as saying that I am a massive Andy Stanton fan, as I'm sure everybody is completely aware. And I actually can't wait to read it.
Right. That's not necessarily an objection to AI or promotion of AI. That's your trust of Andy to do it properly, isn't it?
Exactly is that. Because before everyone turns off the podcast in horror, if you actually read Andy's books or, you take the time to find out about him, you'll know that he is a writer that likes to play around. You know, he likes to subvert people's expectations, and he likes to mess around with form.
He's a cheeky monkey, isn't he?
He's a cheeky monkey. Yeah. He's mischievous. Mm-hmm. That's a good word for him.
Yeah, linguistically mischievous.
Yeah, but he's also incredibly dedicated to and fascinated by the craft of writing. So I feel like I can sort of see what his fascination with AI writing is, because if you're interested in it, then you're going to be absolutely fascinated in a similar way to me being interested in it. And we did that episode on AI writing because it is...
We did it ages ago, John, because we're like proper cutting edge. Do you know what I mean?
Way ahead of the curve.
Early adopters, whereas the laggards are just getting into it now.
But when I read the article...
You read the article?
Yeah, because there are versions of it available for free on the internet.
I don't see how you can form an opinion after you've read the article.
Reading the actual article. Oh. But I was thinking, he's going to be having fun with the idea of AI writing. He's going to be playing with it. And the fact that it doesn't write like a human, he's going to be making a point about the creative process. He's going to be making it funny.
It's possible that Andy might be our saviour against the singularity and our robot overlord. That he is the one
man
that can tie it back in knots as it churns out this stuff and just it'll start questioning its own existence and just go, well, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
If you're just going to take the piss out of me, I'm not doing it. That's what it'll do to the robots. Chat BLT.
Just stop them in their tracks.
Yeah.
They'll be like, don't want to do it anymore.
I don't like it. He's being mean. But I think that's the thing, isn't it? You kind of, from what we know about Andy, he's going to be using it as a tool and as a catalyst. A catalyst is the word I'm searching for.
Exactly. Yeah. He's having a dialogue
rather than cheating. Yeah. It's not shortcut.
No, he's not doing it because he can't be asked writing
a
book.
Cheating. And I think that's what came across on the Twitter storm was all basically formed around the idea that it was a shortcut.
Exactly.
He was cheating. He wasn't putting in the legwork. He wasn't thinking about anything.
Exactly.
The computer was doing it all for him, which is probably quite a normal reaction, a historical reaction to everything, isn't it? To any time a new technology comes in that somehow it's some massive shortcut and takes away that bit of human input. And from the days back in being people putting machines in factories that can make cotton quicker and the original Luddites. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of been there forever. Probably the printing press. Was a similar thing. How you should be writing it by hand. How can
you're putting so many monks out of jobs?
Yeah, think about the monks and their illuminations.
But what pisses me off is just this massive moral outrage pile on because Twitter, basically.
Yeah. But do you think some of that was driven by the insecurities of the people on there? The often the unpublishedness of people.
Yeah,
that feel
I think
they've
it's
been
a little
their
bit
head against a brick wall.
Yeah, it's a little bit that because I think people feel like they've. Almost like this is a publishing slot.
Yeah, that's gone. It's gone now. That chance is gone.
That should have been a real writer taking that slot. But I also think it's mostly because the article was behind a paywall and no one was actually bothering to find out more
Andy's
about it.
Andy's got a very hittable face, hasn't he, Andy? Do you know what I mean? That's the thing.
Yeah, and that was the
I mean, I was glad when we interviewed him that it was over Zoom so we couldn't actually, do you mean...
Yeah,
otherwise,
yeah.
I would have been over
lash
that
out
table
at him.
Before we'd even like done the introductions.
Oh, God, easily, yeah.
Just to give him a smack. But,
listen, I found something on Andy's agent's website.
All right.
And I was really pleased to read it because I thought this is kind of exactly what I was thinking is going on. Most people regard AI chatbots as streamlining tools, as all-powerful research engines, or even as an imminent threat to their livelihoods. But Andy Stanton sees things a little differently. Diving gleefully into the conversation, Andy invites ChatGPT to co-write a novel with him. From a simple initial prompt, man and machine find themselves dancing a bizarre cross-species tango as together they build an increasingly hallucinogenic yarn around a benevolent blue whale and his underwater world. Sometimes the AI wants to play along, sometimes it doesn't. It all adds to the mix. This Leviathan improvisation raises all sorts of fascinating questions about language, creativity, and how we understand stories. Andy interrogates these themes in his extensive and discursive annotations to the text, to deliver an exploded diagram of a novel that examines the DNA of narrative itself.
So he's not subverting the thought. He's bloody taking it to bits and then done whatever. That's ridiculous. Not as advertised in the headline, is it? That's going to be incredible by the sound of it.
It does. It does sound really good.
Fair enough to say, it does sound brilliant.
It does. So hopefully, when people actually find out about what this is about, they will just calm down a little bit or move on to the next thing to be morally outraged about.
Oh, they'll find something else to be very angry about.
I hope so.
Yeah.
We reached out to him. We sent him a message and he was very
told
nice.
Us to fuck right. Yeah. Didn't he? No, he didn't. Why would he? Why would someone with such hateable face say that? It just puts him further in the line of fire, doesn't it?
No, he was pleased that there were people who kind of understood that probably wasn't what he was trying to do, i.e. just he couldn't be arsed writing a novel.
The irony is, I would imagine, someone as creative and sort of surfing on the edge of language and structure as Andy is would be one of the first people to call you a tit if you said, oh yeah, I've just got ChatGPT to write me a book.
Exactly. Yeah, that is so true. If you're not doing anything interesting with it, you're literally just using it because you can't think of anything because your ideas are a bit poor, then I think he would be quite annoyed.
Yeah, he'd just be disparaging, I would imagine, because it seems to be, so at the minute, it seems to be established that the ChatGPT stuff isn't capable of coming up with a particularly fresh look on anything, or it's regurgitating. Mm. It just scrapes and regurgitates. Mm. So it's never going to do anything brilliant at the minute. I'm sure in the future, eventually, it will make us all redundant and put us into some kind of Mad Max situation, certainly creatively, if nothing else. Mm. I'm thinking about retraining and becoming like a something anything physical.
Well, even that, mate.
It's not going to become like, it's not going to be able to be a bin man, is it? Or a gardener, is it?
The robots will do all that.
I'm thinking maybe mime artist then is the only. I don't think they'll be able to do that.
There won't be any jobs apart from mime artists.
Mime artist market will be going
and
mental.
those statue people. In town centres.
Which is ironic because a lot of them do like robot stuff, don't they? They behave like robots.
It'll be robots stood around applauding humans pretending to be robots, won't it?
Doesn't bear thinking about. And to think Andy Stanton started all this.
It's all his fault.
He's going to go down in history, isn't he?
Yeah.
On a list of those kind of people. Terrible man. Terrible man.
Anyway, hey, should we tiptoe away from the controversy?
From
now?
Our illuminating intellectual chat and move on to more, normally what we do in the show. Yeah.
I was thinking it's more like, do you remember in cartoons where there's a fight and there's like a cloud of dust and just swinging fists coming out of it? And then one of the characters just sort of steps out of the fray and sneaks away.
Dusts their lapels down and sneaks off.
And the fight's still going on without them. That's what we're doing now. We just move on, sneak away.
Yeah.
Because we have a nice little interview coming up now with a writer with a superhuman word count.
God, so annoying.
I know.
It's just ridiculous. If you didn't know better, you'd say he's cheating and using ChatGPT for that stuff. But no, he's just insatiable, isn't he?
He is. He's written quite a few books. But anyway, we'll find out all about it in a minute. I read his debut book. It is called Good Intentions. His name is Kasim Ali, and it's a really interesting little book. It's kind of a love story, kind of a family drama. And it's sort of about race and about prejudices. And I thought it'd be nice to chat to him. And so here he is. Anyway, today we're thrilled to be joined by a debut author who wrote his first book, annoyingly, over the space of only a few weeks. I think during the lockdowns, but we'll discover more about that in a minute. That book was called Good Intentions, and it's now on bookshelves, and the paperback is out imminently. It's Kasim Ali. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Thank you for saying that thing about the few weeks. I love that I said that in every interview that I ever had, and now people bring it up all the time.
Is it true? Did you make it sound like you made it up?
It is true.
Have you been writing
this
for years? You were writing for years, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah.
This is like his 10-year opus.
Yeah. Overnight success, 10 years.
Been working on it for, two decades. No, I wrote this in 6 weeks from start to finish.
6 weeks, that's ages.
That's so long, right?
Six weeks for a book.
That is
Really annoying, actually.
I called you a debut author there, Kasim, but it's actually, this is only the first book you've had released, isn't it? It's not the first book you've ever written.
No, I sadly have written, or maybe not sadly, I don't know what the right word is, but I've written 21 books before this one.
What?
And
so,
yeah, you can laugh at me.
I'm guessing you're a fast reader. You're a fast writer. When did you actually start writing books? How old were you?
So, I was writing when I was a little kid. I actually have this really funny, sad story of going home when I was like 22 or 23. And my mom is like the complete opposite of a hoarder. She's a thrower awayer. And she every so often is just like, oh, you don't need these things, right? And she's telling me after the fact that she's thrown them away. And I went home and I was really surprised because she offered me this like little tiny homemade book that I'd written, a super short story that I'd written when I was apparently like 4 or 5 years old. And it was of a kid who like went outside into the street and found sneakers, you know, the whole Americanization of the British youth, found sneakers on the road and put them on, and he could run really fast. And he ran so fast that he turned back time and ended up in the time of the dinosaurs and then got eaten by one.
So tragic.
That's got Hollywood movie written all over it.
Well, I think Adam Driver is just about to be in a film like that, isn't he?
Is he? Wow.
It's called 65.
It's just been optioned. I mean, they've stolen your story.
I know.
How has it got out?
Right, Adam Driver, I'm coming for you, my people and me. so, yeah, I've been writing since I was a kid, and it was just a lot of fun, right? Because, I mean, I am the super cliche, super quiet kid, loved reading. And my dad used to tell all these like stories, and he's alive. Don't know why I just
you just put him in the past tense there. Sorry, Dad.
Sorry to you. He is a really good storyteller, so he is able to captivate an entire room of people by telling the most boring story. Like he was born in Pakistan, and he's like telling you a story about the time that he chased a goat down the road, and yet somehow he's managed to make it in the most captivating thing you've ever heard.
That's quite a skill.
Yeah, he's very good at it. I think actually in another life he's like a stand-up comedian who didn't get slapped by Will Smith. And so he's telling all these stories, and as a kid I was like, I want to do that. And so I became like the joker at school who like told all of these stories and got everybody laughing. And I just like transitioned to the pen really quickly. This is a very long way of saying I used to do like a lot of stuff with making things up for a long time, but it wasn't until I was 17 that I actually started writing like full actual books. So my first one I wrote when I was 17 in my second year of college, and it was like circa 80,000 words or something like that. And it was a story about a group of friends who all die at the end because they're so sad.
I mean, you've got to go through that, haven't you?
We've all been there, you know, the sad teenager who's like, woe is me. And there's actually nothing wrong with your life. So yeah, I didn't really start submitting until I was like post-university. I think that was when I sort of realized I'm reading books that are published and people get paid to do this, so why not me?
And with all those books, with those 3 million books that you wrote in 4 weeks, whatever, was there like a thread running through them, a genre, a style? Like, what was the?
So I'm a Pakistani Muslim, so I just literally was like, "What if the Hunger Games but Muslim?" Which is a really interesting thought experiment, actually. So I would just take whatever I was enjoying at the time and put Muslims into it. So I like. Okay. Yeah, I wrote The Martian.
I mean, you could run with that for years.
That's endless, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I don't know if Andy Weir would be so happy about it.
just love the fact that you just keep pitching stuff. I've written a sitcom. It's Friends, but... and just everything.
But Chandler is a Muslim.
Yeah.
But that's basically what I did, and it was really fun. And I remember, I rewrote The Hunger Games, I rewrote The Maze Runner, Game of Thrones, like all kinds of stuff.
And these are books that you're just writing them for you, or you're planning to send them to an agent, or what's happening at this stage? This is early on.
Yeah, no, at the time I was writing them just for me.
No, I get that. That's why I write.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I also work in publishing.
Yeah.
So I meet a lot of writers and they're always talking about road to publication, journey to publication.
Yeah.
for me, it was never, at the beginning, it was never about that. It just was so much fun to just write a story and see where it goes. And
that's quite liberating, though, isn't it, in terms of the writing process, because you're not trying to please anyone. You're not trying to fit into, oh, this is the current thing that's selling.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much freedom with coming from just writing for yourself. And the way that I write is that I don't plan anything. And I guess maybe it was because at the beginning, the books were already written. I was just putting Muslims in them, right? So
yeah, someone else had done all the planning for you. And the editing and the idea. Yeah.
Was that the case with Good Intentions as well then? That was an unplanned, unplotted book.
Yes, so...
Kazim tells us who he copied it off. No, that's just...
that's Pride and Prejudice.
Just with Muslims.
No, I didn't plan it. And it's really funny because it's written in a non-linear structure because I thought that was the best way to write the story at the time. And my agent was like, we may have to move some stuff around. And I was like, oh, go ahead. I don't really... Yeah, whatever. And she was like, oh, but... I'd like to see your plan and your structure and how you thought about it. And I was like, yeah, it doesn't exist, actually, that document you're looking for. And my editor was the same way. And when I told her I hadn't planned it, she just didn't believe me for a little while and was like, no, it's okay if you did. Like, we can talk about it. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm really sorry. We can change whatever we want. Like, I don't, yeah.
There is no plan.
There's no plan.
That's quite impressive if it is non-linear and there's bits kind of... all over the
show. To write it in 6 weeks as well or whatever and not to have a plan, that is quite a feat, I think.
Yeah. The way that I like to talk about my writing is that it's just vibes, you know. I begin with an idea, you know, for Good Intentions. It came because I watched a film called The Big Sick and I got really angry. And I literally was like, I'm going to do this, but my own version of it.
And what angered you?
So have you guys seen The Big Sick?
I know of it, but I've never seen it.
So The Big Sick is Kumail Nanjiani, who's a Pakistani-American comic slash actor now, I guess. Basically, just he wrote his own life story, which is that he met his wife, who is a white woman, which is important to the story. And they started dating and they got really, you know, they fell in love, basically. And then she got really sick and she went into a coma. And he decided he was going to write this into a film and they made it into a film. Judd Apatow, I think, produced it or directed it, maybe. And the thing that really frustrated me was that I was quite excited about it because he is a Pakistani Muslim. At the time, I think he was Muslim. I don't believe he is anymore. I'm not really sure. But here is somebody writing about his own experience and it's him. He's like acting in it and he wrote it. Like, this is going to be incredible. I was really excited for it. And then I sat down and watched it. And actually, it's a real shame because I think what he does is his wife, the woman in the film, she gets a lot of nuance and a lot of space to be a completely whole person. But his mom and the other brown women in his life. So there's like a sort of running joke that his mom is setting him up with a lot of arranged marriages. And he's meeting these women and they're all kind of like one dimensional. So they're all just like talking about, I want to be a wife and I want to have kids.
Right.
And his mom is just like, when are you going to get married? Whereas his love interest gets to be funny and smart and sexy and aspirational and all these things. And I got really frustrated with it. And I thought, I kind of want to see an interracial romance that doesn't feature a white person, firstly, but also I kind of want to see something that lets non-white women kind of be whole people.
Yeah. These aren't people that you recognize, really, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, like, don't get me wrong, my mom loves to talk about marriage, but she also loves to talk about, you know, other things. My mind is going real blank right now, but I promise you, she loves talking about other stuff. But, you know, like, the women in my life, my friends and people in my family, like, they have jobs and careers and aspirations and they're funny, but they're also, like, cruel sometimes and they are sad as much as they are happy. And yeah, they have so much going on because guess what? Women are people too. And non-white women are also people and they have all of these things. And so I just found myself really frustrated with that. And I wanted to write something that sort of spoke to it.
Yeah. I got the feeling reading Good Intentions that you were quite enjoying kind of tearing up some of sort of common stereotypes about British Muslims, like Noor's best friend is gay and Noor is a good kid, but he still smokes a bit of weed and has a secret relationship. And it's almost like he's kind of, it's like he wants to redefine the terms of his parents' culture in a way and their religion to a certain extent. Like, he's questioning some of the attitudes, especially within an older age group. Was that like a deliberate decision that you wanted to do that? Or are you just writing about the people that you know? Do you know what I mean? Is that a slightly different thing?
Yeah, I kind of... It's really interesting because I think the question is sort of kind of touches on this larger conversation of representation, which I think I have really conflicted feelings on. So to answer your question first, I think when I was writing it, I sort of was just like, you know, he can't be the kind of boy who follows everything his parents set out for him, because then he wouldn't really enter into this relationship. There's no story there, right? So he kind of has to be the person who breaks a few rules and does a few things that his parents wouldn't want him to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I didn't want this to be yet another story of a Muslim person in whatever kind of culture, basically saying, my culture is backwards, my family is backwards, I'm going to run away from it.
Yeah, I reject this. Yeah.
Absolutely. We've seen so much of that. And while those stories are true, and there are loads of people in the world who feel like that, there are also lots of people in the world who don't feel like that and see their families as a source of love, even as their families are a source of tension. And so, yeah, I kind of wanted him to be the person who's, you know, trying to navigate these cultural specifics. He's just trying to figure himself out. He's trying to figure out where the boundaries of him are and the shape of his life in comparison to his family's. You know, where does he lie? And, you know, I've had criticisms from Muslim readers. There was a Goodreads review. You know, some advice to the writers reading this: don't read your Goodreads review. I can do it because I'm an editor, so I've got some you know, resilience there. But it said something along the lines of, like, did not finish this, stopped reading this at page 12.
Or at least they gave it a good go then.
Yes, you know, 300 and something pages.
I mean, that's, really got indeed, that's pretty fair of them, isn't it? I mean, they're giving it
more than 10.
Yeah.
And they'd asked Goodreads to remove the Islam tag from the book. And that was really interesting to me. So I went back to the book and I was like, what happens at page 12? And at page 12, Noor's best friend Imran is introduced, who is a gay Muslim character. And I sort of realized, oh, right, okay. This.
That's where I lost you.
And then I felt really conflicted about it, because on one hand, I was like, yes, there are Muslims, along with other members of other religions, believe that homosexuality is a sin, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, I just was like, you didn't give him a chance. You didn't give me a chance. You didn't give the book a chance. You just made this assumption. It was quite obsessing, actually, because I just was like, I'd hoped that someone like that would continue reading this book. And then I had some other criticisms, people saying that it wasn't very, you know, they felt quite disappointed that the Muslims in the book did smoke weed and that they had premarital relationships, which is a sin in Islam, and that, you know, why can't we get a book where the Muslims are just perfect Muslims and praying five times a day? And
why can't we just have some lovely two-dimensional characters that don't ruffle any feathers or cause any drama?
And I'm like,
that would be...
Yeah, it's like, that does not make a good story. But also, and this is like the bigger conversation about representation, I feel like we're at this very interesting point in time where there are certain people who are allowed to be messy. And by certain people, I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of stories about women, particularly young white women, allowed to be messy and have bad sex and in books, and kind of make, like, Otessa Moshfegh's entire career is based upon, like, what if this white woman went crazy? But
and that's seen as liberating and moving the discussion forward.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
It's like, here's the thing. I'm fully on board with that. I think absolutely we should be able to see complex, dark, evil, messy women just as much as we have been seeing men in that space. But then when it comes to what I've been seeing, the conversation around non-white representation is that people get so angry for two things. One, if it's not a perfect representation of that specific group of people, which is such an impossible thing to do. There are like 2 billion Muslims in the world. There is absolutely no way one person can represent even 1% of those people. And then the other thing that they get angry about is if that representation isn't their representation, the way that they live their lives. And this one really bothers me, because actually I was at an event with an author talking about this kind of stuff. And I remember saying to him that, like, I am one of four. So I have 3 siblings. We are all so, so, so different from one another. And we were born and raised in the same environment with the same parents, went to the same school. And yet we are so completely different. How am I going to, as an author, be able to represent the specific worldview and the life that you, an unknown reader to me, has, when I couldn't even do that for my own brother? Because we are so different. It just feels like a very limiting conversation right now. And I feel like it's a real controversial take to have, but I feel like sometimes it's your own people, quote unquote, who sort of hold you up to higher levels of like perfection and criticize you the most. Because actually, it's the white readers who, well, some of them are like, what's a samosa? And I'm like, oh my God, come on. But most of them are very nice about the book and talk about how, you know, it was really refreshing to read something like this from a non-white male perspective. So I find that really frustrating. And I talk about it constantly. And I just don't know how we move it forward.
I think probably just by doing it again and again, I imagine. I mean, yeah, I suppose the question is, what are you going to books for? You know, if you want to read books because you want to purely be entertained or something, then there are books for that. But it feels to me that literature's about trying to discuss things. I mean, it's almost like every book is a thought experiment.
The idea of going to literature or a book to just reaffirm your narrow worldview is quite a strange concept, really, isn't it? In the history of the fiction book, it doesn't really fit with why it exists. It's kind of like the entire opposite of what you feel it should be doing, really.
And I completely understand that, like, you know, when you watch a TV show like that Bodyguard TV show that came out a couple of years ago, I think, which featured terrorism from Muslim people, you kind of think, okay, like, why are we having this story yet again? Why are we going down this route? I completely understand criticizing that kind of content, because that is quite limiting. That is quite dehumanizing. But when you have writers such as myself who are trying to write about their own experiences, trying to write about how they see the world, trying to reflect themselves, like, I don't get that criticism.
I mean, I can sort of understand it in the sense that I think it's very tempting to want to celebrate your own culture, isn't it? And especially when you're a community that, you know, potentially are already quite marginalized, you maybe want to turn a bit of a blind eye to the things that are more difficult, more complicated. But that's why I really like this book. You know, it feels unflinching. It feels real. You know, your close relationships are the ones that are the hardest to talk about. They're the most confusing. And I think that's why you've got to keep doing it.
Yeah, well, I did just finish writing book 2.
Oh, good.
It only took me...
He's just done that while you're talking.
Yeah, literally as we were talking.
Doesn't take him very long. Yeah.
When you say book 2, is that this isn't a continuation of Good Intentions. This is a completely separate book.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not a fan of sequels because, listen, I'm not James Cameron. I can't do it, okay? You know, he keeps doing it. I don't know how he does it.
Hey, listen, when the money runs out, you'll be doing it.
Good Intentions, too good to intention? What? How would we...
Be like, right, it's Titanic, but we're Muslim.
Somehow, Nude finds himself on a boat in the early 1900s. No, book 2 is a standalone, which I've been working on for the past... Actually, you're not going to like this, but I just finished writing it. Took me 2 months, but it's twice as long as Good Intentions. So,
oh, come on!
Wow,
hang on. I'm just thinking about this, right? You started writing books 17. So you've been writing, let's call it 10 years. You've written 22 novels. By that reckoning, I should have written like nearly 70 novels by now.
Only if you can.
I was starting to like you, Kasim.
Okay, sorry. Let me.
And that brings our interview to an end. Thanks for joining us. Goodbye.
I have no problem with someone writing stuff that quickly, Kasim. But I do think if you do write that quickly, it should be rubbish. I don't think you should be able to do it that quickly and also get like lauded for the content you're producing. Just my view.
Fair enough, and I take that on board. But it did get edited, and the editing took, you know, months of me and my editor going back and forth and adding bits and taking away bits. So I'm always like, yeah, the first draft took me... I'm like a very, very quick drafter. So like in complete honesty, like while I was writing book 2, which RIP to my editor, just came in at 161,000 words. Sorry to her. I would literally finish my job at like say 5 p.m. and if I wasn't going for a run or to the shop or whatever, I would put my work laptop away and then pull out my personal laptop and be writing for like 90 minutes straight after work. And then I would probably watch a film or have dinner or and then when I got back from whatever I was doing, I would spend another half an hour writing before I went to bed. So like every day I was doing like 2 hours.
That's not a lot though,
isn't it? That feels like quite a lot of time for me.
I mean, it's great. Just the fact that you've got a full-time job and you're still writing. See, Tom and I have been using that excuse for ages. And yeah, this isn't helping.
Sounds a bit shaky now, doesn't it?
Just starting to feel like maybe there are other things going on, Tom.
I can't deny or confirm. I can't do anything about that. Sorry.
And I noticed on your website, on your little bit about you, it does say that you're working on your third novel. Currently.
I actually finished...
Or 25th novel, depending on how you...
Yeah.
Yeah, I finished writing that last year, and yeah, I'm now writing book 4 and some other stuff.
Jesus, can't even keep up. Okay.
Yeah, I write all the time. I write constantly. Wow. It's every day for me. And it's not like a chore. I think that's been a really interesting...
Sounds more like an addiction.
Are you trying to make this seem like a bad thing? My God.
No, it seems like there is obviously a massive compulsion. Just like, could you even imagine not being, if someone said, right, you're not allowed to write anymore, what would that do to you?
Yeah, I have no idea. When I get sick, I get so angry because I can't write. Yeah. And it really, like, I get so angry about it because all I can think about is I've always got like projects going on, right? And here's the thing, it's like not all of them are for publication. Some of them, most of them, nearly all of them really, are just because I'm like, wouldn't it be really fun to try to write a film? Wouldn't it be really fun to try to write a 60,000 word book in like lesser form? Wouldn't it be really interesting to write in the first person or whatever? I just do it because of that. And when I can't write, like, for example, I've got two very good friends. We're trying to plan this, like, staycation thing where we, like, hire an Airbnb and then lament Airbnb and what they're doing to the housing economy whilst we're in one.
Yeah, fight it from the inside, brother. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, Dave said that I can't take my laptop with me.
Which
is like absolutely brutal. And I've been literally negotiating with them for like 2 weeks saying, please let me take my laptop. And they're like, no, you finish writing your book. When we do this staycation, leave your laptop at home and it'll be better for you. It'll be good for your mental health. And I'm like, it doesn't feel good for my mental health.
It feels like, you know, like if you had an alcoholic or something that was sneaking a hip flask and pouring it into the coffee, you'll be sat there with a notebook. And you'd be sneaking it out and just writing. And they're going, what are you doing? You're writing a book.
It's not a laptop.
And no, it's just a shopping list. I'm writing a shopping list.
They did say they were going to monitor my phone usage because you can obviously like write on your phone. And I was like, this is feeling bad, guys, actually. I don't like this.
This is like an intervention, isn't it? Like a...
wow. Yeah, rehab, basically, isn't it?
Rehab for the guy who keeps writing too much.
I'd quite like to maybe talk a bit less about your success, Kasim. How many of those books that you wrote have been submitted and rejected?
Okay.
And sorry to focus on the negative here, but
that's kind of
our thing is failing. And we really like to pick away at that scab. So
I absolutely love talking about failure because my father has deemed me one since the moment I was born.
You the big family disappointment then?
Oh my God, absolutely. Are you kidding me? I'm 28 years old, I'm not married, and I live with a woman who is not my wife. I know, devastating. And guess what? I'm not even dating her. She's just a friend. We just share a flat together. It's very disappointing. Failure is like a really big thing for me. That sounds like, that makes me sound like the biggest loser on the planet. Because I not only write books, I also was like, I'm going to try to get into the publishing industry, which is like one of the most competitive places to try to get a job at. So I've been through rejection, my God, basically my entire adult life. So when I finished university and I started sending these books out to people, I only started doing that when I found myself writing original ideas. So instead of doing the whole what if X with Muslims, I actually started writing things that I was just thinking of myself. That's when I began looking for agents and sending stuff out. I got rejected constantly. I think out of the 21 books that I wrote before Good Intentions, I would say half of them got rejected by agents. And the rejection letters, emails were completely just automated emails, copy and paste jobs. Because nobody liked what I was putting out there. But the thing is I guess by that point, because I had spent those 4 years, let's say 17 to 21, just like writing a book, finishing it, starting a next one, it was already ingrained in me that even though this got rejected, I'm just going to start another one. Actually, by the point that it did get rejected, I was already like 10,000 words into the next one.
I was going to say, for a lot of writers, they'll be like, oh my God, I've spent like 2 years writing this and it's been rejected and now it's going to be another two. You'd be like, well, that was a waste of 3.5 weeks. I'll write another one.
Well, yeah.
Probably helps with the resilience when you feel like you've got so many words coming out of you.
I mean, absolutely, right? Because I was writing so much and it was such a joy. I think this is the thing that I always go back to is it is fundamentally such a joy for me to sit down and write a book. It's never felt like a chore. It's never felt hard. It's never felt impossible. It's just such a joy for me to do it. I love it so much that when those rejections came in, I didn't think I was a bad writer. I thought this book didn't work, so let's just write another one.
What a fantastic attitude to have, that is.
That is brilliant.
Really? Yeah, I mean, I really do put it down to the fact that I was just writing for joy and I've continued that throughout. And then with my publishing career, that was different because that is quite personal. That is a rejection of you. Like, you're the product you're trying to sell, and then they say no, and you're like, okay, there's something wrong with me. So I found that quite hard because I was very lucky at the beginning of my publishing career. I had a 6-month internship at Faber & Faber, which was paid, and I moved to London, and I didn't know anybody, and I was very poor, and I used to walk everywhere. And I thought, okay, I'll get a job after this, and I just didn't for quite a while. And then when I did get a job, it was at a super small, badly managed indie in the middle of nowhere. And when I tried to get a job after that, it took me 18 months and about 100 applications.
Wow.
It's really quite tough on that side of stuff. But again, it was this sort of, I think I have this like sheer force of will where I'm just like, either it's going to happen or I will be dead. Not that I'm going to Emperor Nero myself, but I'm not going to allow myself to not make it. Like, I'll have to be dead for me to not make it. So I just kept doing it. And you know, I had this friend of mine at the time who, she's a poet, and she used to send all these poems out and get rejected. And she used to find it really, really difficult. And we'd constantly have these conversations about rejection. And she just never understood how I could go to a job interview, give my all, get invited back for a second one, and then not get the job and immediately just like go apply for another one. She just didn't get it. And she actually, it was really interesting. We would have conversations where she would say, this is really unhealthy. You need to sit with your feelings. And I would just keep saying to her that there are no feelings because the only feeling is like determination.
Yeah. I mean, if that's the job you want, you just got to keep plugging away, haven't you, I suppose?
Yeah. And I'm really honest about that with people when I talk to prospective publishing hopefuls. That is quite difficult. And it took me like a really long time. And there are some people who've had an easier journey into it, but I had quite a tough one and this is what it looked like, but I just kept going. And I genuinely think that even though it was quite difficult at times when I started to wonder, am I the problem? I think having had all those rejections for my books and being able to keep going there, I think that fueled like my determination on this side. And I think they were working in tandem and I just kept going. And then it's one of those, I hate that this is the way that it happened because it's such a cliche, but in 2019, I wrote Good Intentions and I sent it to 3 agents. I really looked them up and I you know, because at the beginning I was just sending them out to anybody, but then you sort of hone, you know, as I learned about the publishing industry, I was like, actually, I'm just like, this is really bad for me. I shouldn't be doing this. I should be being specific. So I chose three agents and I sent it to them and they all rejected it within 24 hours. And I was like, ah, great, cool. Let's just, yeah, fine, whatever. And then a couple of things happened. I got longlisted for the Mo Sutran prize that Hachette were doing, which is a prize set up by, I believe she used to be a rights person who worked at Hachette and she passed away. And her husband set this up as her kind of legacy. So I got longlisted for that. I had a short story accepted for publication in the Good Journal, which is really exciting. And I got a job offer from Penguin. And then I sent it out to three more agents. And then Juliet Pickering, my agent, offered me representation. So those things happened in all such quick succession.
Yeah.
And it really felt like, it just felt like a movie in that I didn't really truly believe that it was real. And so I moved to London to start working at Penguin. I hired my agent, who's genuinely incredible. And then COVID happened, because of course it did. And then we sold the book, because of course it was in peak lockdown, where I was stuck in my like 4x4 room that I was paying so much money for, that had become basically like a cell, that we sold this book and I was unable to celebrate it.
That is harsh. I feel like publishing, well, I suppose lots of mainstream media, took a very long time to respond to the idea that there's an appetite for diverse voices. But it feels like there is a kind of a barrier has broken now. And not only are there books for people who haven't necessarily been represented in the past, but actually a lot of those books have even found a mainstream audience as well across lots of walks of life. You must have seen that kind of happen close up as someone who's been working in publishing for the last few years. Does that feel like that's beginning to happen more and more?
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm quite cynical. I think this is the only place in my life where I'm quite cynical about something, which is an allusion to a conversation we had before the podcast began recording. That's in the Patreon link, actually, for subscribers.
Yeah, just click here for that discussion.
I'm really quite cynical about this discussion, because I think that from the outside, it may look like that. But when you're on the inside, actually, the reality is that, you know, I said this thing like 2 years ago, and it's kind of still feels very true, where I believe I was talking to somebody who said that there's a glass ceiling for women in publishing, as there is kind of everywhere. And then I said, but there's a concrete ceiling for non-white people. And I believe that's still kind of true. And by that, I mean, there are a lot of diversity initiatives. Let's just talk about non-white people specifically, because I think that's where a lot of the noise has been. A lot of non-white people get into publishing at the assistant level. Half of them leave because they realize, I'm getting paid nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I just can't afford to live in London. I don't want to live in London, and this environment isn't for me. So like literally, I think half of them leave. The half who stay work really, really hard to get promoted, and then only get promoted to a very mid-junior level. So editorial assistants will become assistant editors. Out of those assistant editors, so few of them will become actual editors. Out of those editors, two of them might become the step above. And so the higher you go up, that you see that the people who are actually making these decisions, they're all white people. And that's the problem for me.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing is like, I will always point to Toni Morrison and James Baldwin as like examples that this like idea that publishing, I think, is trying really hard to sell at the moment, which is, oh my God, people now want to read Black and Brown voices. No, that's just simply untrue. Not only have Black and Brown people been readers the entire time that literature has existed, they've also been writers. So like this idea that it's just in the last like 10 years that suddenly Black and Brown people have like discovered literature is completely untrue.
Clearly, yeah.
And it really, it frustrates me to no end. In publishing, you hear these like senior people talking about it like it's a brand new thing. And you're like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, there's like another slice of the pie, right? Which is, let's talk about editing, because I think it's really important to have non-white people across the board, but editors are quite important because they literally buy the books and publish them. If you don't have non-white people in editorial positions high enough up where they can make the really big advance deals, where they can make those decisions as to like the shape of a list, like a publishing list for the next 3 years, then you're not going to get those books in and they're not going to get published well. But what also happens is that sometimes those books do come in and they get bought and published, and they get published horrifically. And what I mean by that is the editing is bad.
Right.
Because, and I think it's twofold. I think editors, some white editors feel scared that we can't edit this book because we will be seen as trying to censor.
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah. You know,
that's like a fascinating, strange thing that's happening. But on the other hand, they just don't know how to publish something that doesn't look like them and doesn't speak to them. And so sometimes books will come in that challenge the sort of ingrained definition that a reader is a white middle-class woman living in North London. And they don't know how to publish a book like that. So then they just try to publish it to that market. And then sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. There are all these problems, and no one really seems to be wanting to have the actual conversation. So instead they just lean on, we have a diversity program, or we did this like really big book deal for a black woman for six figures. We did that one time last year, so we're like, good.
So that box has been ticked, thank you. Right, back to normal.
Don't need to buy another one for like 2 years. And the irony of it, is that America is so much better than us in this regard because, and I think it's got to do with how America and Britain approach the specter of racism. Yeah. And I think America is just so much more open about having those conversations that it just feels like the conversation there is like years ahead of where we are here in the UK.
There does feel like a sort of attempt at colour blindness in the UK, I think, to a certain extent. We don't like to look it straight in the eye.
Yeah, it's I could talk about this forever. And here's the thing. I'm an editor and my line manager is a Pakistani Muslim woman. I've never had a Pakistani Muslim anything in any team that I've been in.
Yeah.
So this is like incredible. What an incredible position to be in. I'm an editor, so I get to buy books now. How cool. Hopefully I'll be able to get a promotion or change jobs and get a more senior position. And hopefully my career continues like that. I can point to a handful of other non-white editors across the industry who are doing the work. I just think, as always, there needs to be more work done. But I think publishing gets off really lightly because they do the big thing and they pay six or seven figures for like a one book a year. And then they get to feel like they've done the work, and actually they haven't. And what I found personally is, you know, when you try and have these conversations with people, they just turn around and say, I'm not racist. And you're like, I'm not. I didn't call you a racist. I was talking about structural problems within the way we work. I'm not a racist, though.
It's much more complicated than that, yeah.
Yeah, I could name and shame. I won't, though. I need to keep my job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's stop talking about it. Let's move on. Do you know what we haven't talked about?
What haven't we talked about?
I was going to ask you just to tell us a bit more about the story of Good Intentions.
Oh, you're going to get me to self-pitch.
We kind of talked about why you wanted to write it, but give us a flavour of the story.
Sure, okay. I've been doing this for a year. It should come really easy to me, hopefully. Yeah, so Good Intentions is the story of Noor, who is a young Pakistani Muslim boy, I guess, because we first meet him when he's like 19 and then at the end he's like 24. And he meets Yasmina, who's a Sudanese Muslim woman, which is to say she's black, and they are real cutesy and they get into a relationship with each other and oh, how fun is this, except then like the sort of core conflict of the book is that Noor doesn't want to introduce Yasmina to his parents or in effect take any kind of step forward because he believes that his parents are anti-black because of the sort of nature of South Asian communities and that sort of anti-blackness that's quite prevalent in them. Yeah, it sort of explores that relationship. I very much did the debut novelist thing where I try to talk about too many things. So it also deals with like friendships and the expectations of friendships, the relationship between parents and their children and what is expected of children, but also what is expected from parents, deals with homophobia in the Muslim community, all kinds of things, really fun. And anxiety, mental health, there's also that in there too, because I thought, you know, why not? And yeah, essentially it's about, I think if I was to like say it, sort of log line or whatever, it is very much about the sort of anxieties of like millennial Muslims in Britain today.
That was very good.
Oh, thank you.
That was very succinct. You can tell you've been doing that a lot. We've taken up a lot of your time, Kasim, but I have a question to ask you now.
Always saves his awkward question for the end. Kasim, so
yeah,
brace,
I do.
Brace yourself.
Let's say we finished the chat, right? And this is just between you, me, and Tom, right?
Okay.
How did you do it? Come on. How do you write a book in a few weeks? How can Tom and I achieve a book in 6 weeks? What's the real secret?
Wow.
Be more talented and actually do it. Are those the things?
Well, here's the thing.
Seems
right?
like those are the things.
There's got to be a secret, Tom. There's got to be something that we haven't figured out yet,
John. There isn't a shortcut. It's just doing it, isn't it? You've got to do it.
Well, I don't know the intricacies of your life. You know, I will just put my hands up here now and say that I have no children. I have no pets because my landlord.
Yeah. Get rid of the kids and the pets.
Yes.
Yeah. Can do that.
So if you do those two things, and then I guess if you just...
What, so you're saying get divorced and
just get rid of the
Well, I didn't say get rid of your partner.
Baggage. Get rid of the baggage.
You know, your partner might be there to, you know, really emotionally support you.
Not when I've got rid of the kids and the pets, man.
She'll go ballistic.
Right, sorry.
She's going to be angry. So she's going to have to go too.
So basically...
Do you want any kids or pets? That's him, just while we're on.
Do I want them?
Yeah, I got kids are lovely, so well behaved. Okay, we'll maybe look at other options.
Yeah, maybe. Get rid of them, and then I guess just have this sort of absolute cold, hard determination that you are going to do it, because if you don't do it, then your father was right about you all those years ago.
Okay. I think I get it now. Yeah. Okay.
And I can tell you that. I bottled it up. Don't worry about it.
I mean, we all need motivation from different places. You know what I mean? It's important.
I think genuinely, to answer the question quite genuinely, actually, for me, it is very much about like the joy. I think it's the joy.
Yeah.
That hasn't left me yet. And I really hope it doesn't. But it is just such a joy to do this that I am like quite sincerely every day grateful that I get to do it, that I, you know, have fingers and I have a laptop and I have the time to do this. Like genuinely, I'm not even kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Just grateful for those things that allow me to do this.
What about when you hit a really gnarly bit, you know what I mean? Like a real tricky plot point and you just, oh, I don't know how to get through this next bit. You're just still there like, la, la, la.
Well, so, okay, do you remember how I said I don't plan? So when I write my books...
So you'll just write around the plot point.
I guess so. I'm going. Always, like, surprised by myself, if that makes any kind of sense. So the ending of Good Intentions, I didn't know until I wrote it.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So, yeah, I never have a plan. And that keeps the excitement for me. And it's really interesting, in my second book, I actually had to rewrite it, which maybe I should have talked about. I should have talked about that. Damn. But I had to rewrite it because my editor was like, there are all these things that are not working. And I was like, all right, fine, perfect.
Is there a rough kind of idea when that one might be out?
I'm not really sure because, yeah, but my editor, she just basically bought a lot of books last year. So she's steadily working her way through them. I gave myself the arbitrary deadline of like 2 months to write this book. And then I was like 3 days late and I was profusely apologetic. And she was like, I gave you 6 months. Why are you apologizing? So she has it now.
Yeah, your deadlines don't count.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, listen, Miss Editor, I actually work to the beat of my own drum. Thank you.
She's probably used for authors telling her that, but it's probably usually massively the other way around.
Yeah.
She has said that. So she won't get to it for a while. Yeah. So which is why currently I am working on book 4 and a film, because why the fuck not, right?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Well, I got a spare 10 minutes, might as well knock out a screenplay.
Never written one before. Let's see if it's shit. Who knows?
Well, if it is, you can come back on and share it with us.
I'll tell you all about the failure to write a script. And then I'll produce about 20 of them that I've written. And then you guys can just shout at me again.
Yeah, I love that. Love that. Love that.
Well, thanks, Kasim.
Yeah, that was great, mate.
Lovely to meet you.
Thank you very much. I'll see you guys soon. I don't really know how to end these. Bye.
See you.
Bye.
All right, bye, guys.
Well, people were forewarned about his ridiculous word count spewing outness. I mean, that's just mental, isn't it?
It is.
How can you be that age and have written so many books?
I know, and he seems to... The thing that is most upsetting, he seems to...
Enjoy it.
He seems to, A, enjoy it, and B, not spend that much time writing.
Well, now you see, it's interesting you say that. He outlined what he does, that kind of 2 hours a day.
Mm.
But this is the thing, he does that every day. That's part of his absolute inbuilt, set in stone routine.
Yeah, and then not having kids thing, that is a big, big bonus. I mean,
yeah.
I know we're making excuses. We're trying to justify
but
our
there's
own.
A huge thing about putting that time in every day, so it's part of your life. I mean, it's easier for him because he enjoys and looks forward to it. So, I mean, that's a huge win, isn't it?
It is.
That mindset.
Yeah.
Because even, I mean, some of the successful authors we've talked to, do you know, it's a bind and it's a treacle to be walked through. Whereas he's surfing across the top of it, isn't he? He's eating a bit of the treacle
well
as he goes and enjoying the treacle and not getting stuck
it.
In it. That metaphor's gone as far as it will now, so we should probably move on.
I feel like he takes a laptop or a notebook everywhere he goes, doesn't he? And as soon as he gets a moment, he's there, he's writing.
Well, I said, didn't I? It's an addiction. He's kind of, and it is. He can't go on holiday without it. So, yeah, he's...
Anyway, good on him.
Good luck to him.
Good on him.
That sounded genuine, didn't it? Good luck to him. Well done on that, being able to do that.
Yeah,
that's lovely for you. Great stuff.
So, Tommy, what's coming up? What's on next time? We can't say next week anymore, can we? Because it's not next week. It's the week after.
It'll be the week after.
What's coming up next time?
Oh, I'll tell you what we've got next time, Al.
What have we got next time?
We have got the lovely, lovely Ian McMillan.
Oh, we have.
Poet extraordinaire.
Yeah. Broadcaster, poet, raconteur.
And just a bloody nice guy.
He really is.
And he's got some really funny anecdotes and stories.
It's mainly just him doing his raconteur bit, isn't it? Is him just,
yeah, it's lovely.
Just
lovely,
talking about his life in writing and telling his little stories. But make sure you join us for that lovely little episode.
Anyway, that's in a couple of weeks. But before we end today, as our part of our ongoing contribution to the writing community, much valued by all of the aforementioned writing community, we need to do our whip me with your rhythm stick. I don't know what
your rhythm whip.
We're still not coming up with a set name. Well, we've asked people that are listening to send in the start of their current work in progresses for us to have a little look at.
And whatever that is, if it's it could be a short story or a book or a screenplay, whatever it is, we'll stick it on the pile of things that we think sound interesting and we can talk about.
I mean, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but what we realised quite soon when people started sending things in was that we felt massively under-equipped and under-qualified to really offer anything. But Craig Margolis, who we talked about his work on the last episode, he was very grateful. And said we raised some good points and it was very useful. So I think that might be the peak of our...
It's all downhill now.
Yeah, I think it could be it. But very kindly, one of our very most favourite listeners, A.B. Finlayson, has sent us in some of his current work. And I noticed on Twitter the other day that he's actually just finished this as well.
Oh, has he?
So when he sent this in, it was like 3/4 finished a couple of weeks back. And now, literally the other day, just kind of written... The end.
Good work, mate.
So this is a raw first draft, as he was very keen to point out. And I found this one quite interesting because it's called Won't Somebody Please Think of the Orcs? And it's very much set in that kind of fantasy arena. Something I don't really read. I mean, the nearest I can think to this is that I read some Terry Pratchett when I was about 14. And that's probably my only little delve into the world of fantasy, really.
Mm.
So I feel even more unqualified to offer an opinion on this. But to give people an idea of the style and where it's at, here's a little snippet from the very, very start of chapter 1. Orc are often depicted as big, brutish bastards with all the manners of a university rugby club on a night out in Wetherspoons. Ugly, misshapen, and with skin somewhere on the vast colour spectrum of a hammered thumb, orcs are vilified, reviled, and feared. The fact they usually have teeth rivaled only by years of upper-class British inbreeding really doesn't help. Some stereotypes ring true. When it looks like an orc, smells like an orc, and talks like an orc, it probably isn't a pretty princess. And therein lies the problem. stereotypes can be misleading. Let's tell no lies. There are orcs out there who are utter bastards and will eat your nan given half a chance and a bottle of hot sauce. But, and this is crucial, not all of them. This story is about the others. It is about stereotypes, tropes, and misunderstandings. It is also about a call to, admittedly accidental, adventure. Where to begin? Ah yes, the status quo. Let's get rocking all over this world. Banished to the grey north of Torva, pushed back behind the vast threshold into a land of barren plains and sharp mountains, the orcs thrive in the industry of war. It is bleak in the north, colourless and drab, with all the flavour of tinned spam and boiled cabbage. It is no wonder the rest of the world looks up and shudders. The great island continent of Esajova really comes into its own when you head further south, though of course even the great dividing double walls of the threshold can't cut off the grim north entirely. It bleeds beneath the giant stones like a stain, spreading like an oil slick. In fact, it takes a fair few leagues for the colour to really kick in, but when it does, it's all green and verdant fields, lush forests, and beautiful rolling hills. A picture postcard world in which the elves have populated the vast Westeron forests, and the dwarves have built their halls and cities in the mountains on the other side of the continent. Because that is what elves and dwarves do. And there are humans, of course. Those buggers get everywhere. Towns and cities litter Esajova, from the threshold which marks the northern limits of Upir, all the way to the kingdom of Dansaf and the great southern ocean. The world is familiar, comfortable, and easy to understand, if a little derivative. But how it came to be is anyone's guess. It could be that some apocalyptic event plunged the land into a fantasyscape somewhat recognisable to those with a keen eye for a hidden clue. Or it could be that this world is both somehow in a galaxy far, far away and taking place a long, long time ago. Or, you know, that the whole thing is the creation of a simpleton or a group of gods who got bored. We shall see. The story, unsurprisingly, begins with an orc. Sitting on a high rock on a plateau in the north of Esajova, beyond the great twin walls of the threshold itself, inside the orc realm of Torva. You would be forgiven for missing him, as your eye will no doubt be drawn to the vast valley and the huge battle raging far below. Because these things always start with a battle. Our orc's name, by the way, is Gary, and he's bloody annoyed.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. It does have a whiff of the Pratchett, doesn't it?
It does, it does. I think that's why I mentioned it before, really. It's a very difficult thing to do, isn't it? Because you kind of think, God, if you're trying to take influence from someone, it's a great person to take influence from because it's brilliant,
very
but
best.
It's a really high bar to try and get to, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's nice, though. It's, it's a great concept.
It is, isn't it?
To start with.
I mean, you read his reindeer book, didn't you? His reindeer story.
I did.
And
yeah, that was a lot of fun.
It's very readable. It's so easy to read.
Yeah.
He's got a lovely, I don't know what it is, like a rhythm. It's just really easy to kind of absorb and read.
And it's speckled with nice little jokes.
It is.
But you could potentially even miss quite easily.
Yes. I thought this was really interesting reading this, because in that bit that I've just read out there, there's quite a lot of referential jokes, isn't there? To all kinds of stuff about the north and the south, and referencing the genre itself and kind of playing on itself and kind of sort of meta references and everything. And I think obviously that was probably part of his main idea, if you like, that first spark of idea was that it'd be fun to do that as well, and to, you know, reference Star Wars or all these different things that you've got.
Yeah.
And as you read through further on from where I read, because that is literally the start of chapter one as it stands, they kind of take a little bit more of a back seat as sort of the characters and the story come to the fore. I thought it was quite interesting. Obviously, this is a first draft, and that might be something that then gets filtered out or whatever, but I just thought it was quite interesting to see that you could kind of see the idea, the raw idea at the start, if you like, and then you could kind of feel it being shaped and moulded as you kind of read through the couple of chapters.
Yeah, yeah. So where do you think it's going? Do you get a feeling for that?
Not really. Obviously, it moves on to talking about the lives of the two orcs, doesn't it? Gary and Frank.
Yeah, and then in chapter two, you feel like you're meeting the antagonist, the person who's going to sort of help to flip everything upside down and make everything difficult. The kind of the bad guy who has to be vanquished.
Yeah, and I think I said to you, I don't really have that much to say about it, and that's not a bad criticism. That's kind of a John. There's nothing stands out. You think, oh dearie me, what have they done here? It's I think I could actually see myself reading that and enjoying it.
Yeah.
So I think those parallels between this fantasy world drawn into the everyday world is always an interesting thing. And in some ways, it's quite an easy conduit for sort of comedy and amusement.
It is, yeah.
But it's a really nice one.
Yeah. And because orcs are always, you know, you never hear the orcs' motivation.
Yeah, no, they're just grunting beasts, aren't they?
Things. Yeah. They are just incredibly evil. And it's really lovely to be able to get, you know, into their psychology a little bit and hear about orcs' parents and things like that, you know, sort of domestic scenes. So, yeah, it's a very nice idea. Yeah, I just thought there's just funny little moments like, well, I can't find it now, but it's something like it's a one-day walk to this particular place they want to get to, or 2 days by bus. It's little things like that that he just chucks in, and I like that. Like there's little things that you could just easily miss, but it's good.
That is Terry Pratchett, isn't it? That kind of just lying down these things.
Yeah.
And do you know what I thought? Do you know what I thought in this? Obviously, with the fantasy genre, there is kind of a license to use footnotes to your heart's content.
Yeah, the footnotes are good.
I think I'm going to use that in my children's book. Kind of hadn't really occurred to me, but it's quite a nice way of
explaining things without going into a load of exposition,
adding extra bits and kind of getting your jokes in without clunking up the flow of things, which might be nice.
But you don't need them, you don't need to read them.
No,
but they're just like a little extra.
Yeah, no, I think
a little bonus,
nicely dealt with in this. So there you go, we don't really have anything. That's massively unconstructive, isn't it, really?
It's sort of a nut. You're right, there's not enough to go on yet, is there?
Oh, he spelled sunset wrong. He spelled the word sunset wrong.
Oh, yeah. I noticed a few little typo errors.
God.
So we'll be sending you them, Alex. Yeah, really upset about that.
Terrible. Terrible stuff.
Oh, yeah, I gave my dad my first novel to read, and one of the first things he said were, oh, there's quite a lot of errors, John. I've marked them all up for you. Oh, God damn it. Brilliant. Well done, mate.
Yeah, thank you so much for sending that in. Yeah.
You wrote a book. You wrote a bloody book.
Another one.
Oh, yeah, another bloody book.
He's on some kind of Kazim-type blitz, knocking the words out, isn't he?
He is. He's obviously taking the whole writing thing very seriously.
I don't think he could have done it without it. I mean, I think when we started the podcast, he was one of the early adopters, and, I think we've really inspired him, John. It's another one that I think... We have to take
without
a lot
us,
of credit
think,
for.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we don't like talking about it.
Yeah, well done us. Sorry, well done us.
It's only fair to say,
well,
isn't it?
You're welcome, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't mention it. Do not mention
here
it.
Here for you.
Yeah.
Here for you.
John, just before we finish this week's episode,
yes,
we should probably just double check in with each other and ask the question.
Oh God, we forgot the question, didn't
we? Would you like to ask the question? Shall I ask? Who's going to ask the question?
Go for it. You ask it.
Okay. John.
Uh-huh.
What have you been writing this week?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. Not a lot, but I did sit down with Katie and we went back through what we've got for the Happy Marriage Show.
Right.
And have had a little play around with it. We're trying to sort of step outside it and look at the structure a little bit and where it's going to go and the shape of it. And I found that quite useful.
Okay.
That's what we've been doing.
Well, how far through do you think you are, if you had to put a sort of percentage on
it? Well, we've written, I mean, in terms of an actual script, we've written probably, I don't know, 35 minutes of stuff, which isn't a right lot, is it? But it's, I don't know how much of that is going to...
But it's good. It's bloody good.
I mean,
good.
It's incredible
it's good stuff.
No, I don't know how much of that is going to stay.
Yeah.
But we sort of made a decision early on that we were going to almost like just write the presentation as to... marriage social scientists or whatever we end up being, how they would actually do a TED lecture, because we thought that might be quite an interesting starting point. And then how are we going to kind of mess with that and make it all go horribly wrong?
Have you thought about getting ChatGPT involved? Yeah, that's a bit of a thing at the minute.
Do you know, I don't think we will.
No,
I think we're going to leave that out. So Tom.
Yes, John.
What have you been writing this week?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. I have been mainly outlining my kid's book, and I'm really pleased with it, actually.
Well done, mate.
Got a massive piece of paper. Imagine a massive... What's the biggest piece of paper you can imagine?
Oh, it's
imagine
huge, that. Yeah. It's
massive. Oh, and it's not that big. It's like A1.
Oh, okay.
So it's still a sizable piece of paper. But obviously, because this children's book involves sort of a bit of time travel shenanigans, I wasn't quite sure how to get it laid out so my head could understand what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I sort of did a timeline with like arrows, basically looping backwards and forwards and what have you. And it just kind of, it works as I just did the story, and then it comes into the new timeline of the changed timeline. So there's a, yeah, I think I've got a good, certainly a good starting story.
So you visualized it in a way that you can actually understand it. That's good.
Yeah, I think that's what I need to do. I was trying to write it, trying to write it out in order, if you like, and it just wasn't quite, I couldn't, but seeing the actual little jumps in time just really helped get it in, and I think it'll help hopefully avoid some plot holes and errors before we even start. I'm sure there will be plenty once we get
that is
done,
tricky with time travel stuff, isn't it? Especially if there's more than one time jump.
Yeah.
Which it sounds there is.
Oh, there's lots. There's loads.
Oh, right. God.
Fortunately, due to the rules of the universe, it's all going, they can only time travel backwards. So
okay. Good.
That's something that makes it a little bit easier.
Makes it slightly easier.
Yeah, but it is it's a thing. Obviously it's because it's as far as we know impossible, there are always going to be paradoxes, and it's just how you deal with those within the rules of your universe, isn't it?
It is,
in the way that Back to the Future did.
So you've decided what those rules are now?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And I think as well, hopefully it'll be fun to Andy Stanton it a little bit and kind of play with that within the story as well.
Almost refer to how the rules work.
How confusing it is, or how that wouldn't happen, or, do you mean, kind of a bit of... That's kids love that kind of stuff.
Of course they do.
And we could maybe put that in a footnote. So there you go, I've learned a lot.
That sounds great.
Yeah, ticking along. I think I just need to break into that next bit of going, right, let's just get it all out. But I think I've been putting that off for a few days for unknown reasons.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that, if I actually start, then I've started and I've kind of got to go with
it. Can I make an observation, Tom?
Yes, I'll allow it.
You sound more enthusiastic about this than I think anything before.
Anything?
Writing wise.
Right, not like including when we went to that Indian restaurant and stuff.
No.
Okay,
oh, God, no, you were.
No, right, yeah.
Which is, that's got to be good.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's just, I don't know why it is. I don't know if it's just because this is what I should be doing, or whether it just seems like a manageable thing rather than an endless task.
I
don't know.
It's bang on. I think you found your thing.
Yeah, well,
we'll see.
Hey, well done us, both progressing something somewhere.
Moving things along. Brilliant.
And I hope you are too, listeners.
Yes.
Hope you've been writing something.
Tom is now waving his finger.
I know, but this is what we established, John, that we are their muse. We have a responsibility.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Right. We can't just...
Without us, they'd be nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
Well, we should probably get out of their hair and let them do some writing.
Yeah, get on with some work. That's what I say, and we'll see you next time.
Fantastic. Maybe just a little reminder that we are... just a kind of scrawny, puny little independent podcast.
Yeah.
We don't have the might of the great corporate machine standing behind us. So if you like that idea, if you like the idea of supporting independent podcasts, tell a couple of friends about us or post a review. That would be nice.
A glowing review.
Yeah.
Just a glowing, like,
oh, that would be
radioactively
nice.
Glowing review.
Yeah. It doesn't need to be much. Could just say, you know, in fact, if you like, we could write a review for
you. We'd never get around to it, John. You've overpromised there. If they could do it themselves, that would be better.
That would be better.
Yeah.
Hey, maybe at some point we could have a page on the website with just some like suggested short reviews that people could copy and paste for convenience.
Can we just get chat?
That would be good, wouldn't it?
BLT to do it.
BLT. Yeah.
However you want to do it, write as a review. Otherwise, you're not welcome to listen next time. And it's a really good episode. So. I would have found you.
Earn your listening stripes.
Absolutely.
Right, let's get out of here. Yep. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Cheerio.
Take care. Keep writing. Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?
Yeah, all right, perfect. I mean, it's still recording, so there's all this shit at the end that you're going to have to cut out. But listen,
I know, keep it all. We never know what comes in.
Keep everything.
Hearing me chat shit about my editor. Kish, if you hear this, it's lies. It's AI. This isn't actually me.